Hi, welcome to the Orthobiologics Podcast. This is episode 5. I am your host, Dr. Trevor Turner, MD, RMSK, down at Georgia Bone and Joint. Our episode today is titled Too Young to Fail. In this episode, we have the privilege to be joined by Dr. Tom Nabody, who is based in Michigan. If you want to look him up at his clinic, you can find him at his website, which is regenerativemedicinemichigan.com. So our topic for today is stem cell banking. Now, there's some controversy, of course, about where cells come from and where they shouldn't come from and how to store them. And then if they're stored, how to store them in such a way that they're in fact usable and living and available to use in the future. So that being said, I'm going to go ahead and let Dr. Nabody give you a brief summary of where he works and what he does, and also his expertise and his reason for being interested in this platform and this idea. Please go ahead.
Hi, Trevor. Thank you. Yeah, so just a brief history of my background. I am a physiatrist, physical medicine and rehab specialist is my primary specialty, and then did subspecialty training in interventional pain management. Found my way into regenerative medicine, actually through patients, direct care, directing me to that care. They were demanding or were seeking alternatives to surgery, alternatives to simply blocking the pain. And by way of patient requesting information, I did some research and found out that it's something that fits my skill set. Decided to do more education into that. Once I started doing regenerative medicine, I had a colleague introduced me to a company that was banking adult stem cells, which is what got me interested into that field. And as I learned more for personal reasons, I thought it was something that I wanted to invest my financial or my for my health, for my own personal healthcare future. I thought it was something important to invest in. So after I did that, it became an easy thing to talk about for patients.
Yeah. So thanks so much, Tom. So you mentioned that, you know, you were trained as a pain provider. And I thought one of the things you said was really interesting. And that was the reason that you got into this field is because you were no longer, or your patients maybe were no longer satisfied with strategies or treatments that just temporarily blocked some pain. And so obviously there's a distinction between blocking some pain and a longer term strategy, maybe to emphasize better functional outcomes. I mean, that's kind of what you mean when you're talking about a biologics or a regenerative medicine approach. Is that basically how you feel?
It's both patients requesting it and my own personal belief that it's better. The hard part now is, you know, you get in situations where certain, you know, insurances aren't covering it, or it's just for whatever reason not available for patients. And so then you choose your best option, next option. So I haven't completely stopped doing conventional pain management either. But all things being equal, I would choose a regenerative route over a block the pain route every time.
And then that's great. But you used one other phrase that I kind of would want to key in on. And you had said, my personal healthcare future. And so that's, you know, I think maybe a concept that well-informed patients are more and more interested in, because, you know, we see this generation of patients, even the current generation, they're living longer, they're exercising more. I've had patients come in and say, you know, well, I don't want to retire because if I retire, then I've got nothing else to do. And then you know, I've got other people who are saying, well, I'm retiring early because I have so much to do and I have to be so functional and so strong to do a lot of these things. And they're looking at this going, you know, I have a lot of longevity and I have a lot of years to go. How can I optimize the way in which I spend or use that time? And so that's maybe where some of the concept plays in that we're going to talk about today. So when you talk about your healthcare future and you talk about, you know, the best way to preserve that, I mean, explain to me, what is the reason that a patient would be interested in banking their stem cells in the first place?
So I would say the first thing is orthopedics. So that's, while still experimental from an insurance standpoint, I think you and I would agree the science proves that it works. Nothing in healthcare works 100% of the time, but I've seen it. You've seen it. We treat people with regenerative orthopedic treatments like mesenchymal stem cell treatments, and they get better. Their MRIs get better. Their functional levels get better. It definitely works for orthopedics. That's just the tip of the iceberg. So when we're talking about the future that these cells hold, it's not just treating orthopedic problems, which even if that's all it ended up treating, is still worth the investment. But there's over, I think the last count, over 1,000 clinical trials, NIH sponsored, looking at everything that's globally termed an age-related disease, things that happen to us as we get older. Osteoarthritis is one of those things, but so is Alzheimer's disease, so is dementia, so is heart disease, so is COPD, lung disease. Our organs give out. Our organs are all derived from the same mesenchymal tissue. And so the stem cells that we're looking at are mesenchymal stem cells. I would say there's two kind of take-home points from the early studies, and they're both very intuitive. Younger stem cells perform better than older stem cells, and your stem cells are going to perform better than a donor stem cell. So if you can have access to your younger stem cells, that's going to give you a therapeutic advantage in the future.
And when you say, so that raises a good point, because in a prior episode, Tom, we discussed what the meaning of autologous was, and we discussed what the difference was between cells that came from bone marrow versus fat versus trying, you know, people who are opting to try and use off-the-shelf products like umbilical-derived cells or you know, other sources. I actually had a patient come in, and their father, who was in the room with them, is a young quarterback. And he actually asked me point blank, you know, what about umbilical derived cells? And that was one of the things I emphasized. I said, look, you know, your son, you know, is young and very, very healthy. And the power of his own autologous cells, or the power from the cells from his own body, are incredibly powerful. I mean, they're like a super powered up machine. And, you know, there's not a need to try and use other cells or tissue in this case, especially. But for you, when you say younger cells are better, I mean, tell me, you know, we talk a little bit about decade cutoffs and about when cell populations start to decline, or maybe it's related to vascularity, how many blood vessels there are in a given site. So talk a little bit more detail about that, if you would.
That's not something I have. I'm going to tell you what my opinion on that is. I don't want this to be taken as fact.
Okay.
Younger stem cells perform better than older stem cells through what I believe to be the paracrine effect. So I don't think these cells actually grow into tissues themselves. The research or the studies that I've read that have made me come to that conclusion are ones where we tag these cells with a radioisotope, something that can be tracked as it like ages. And essentially after 3 to 6 months, all of those cells have been flushed out of the body.
Tom, will you go back to that? I think there may be some people who listen to this that hear the word radioisotope and they kind of go to another planet, like they're not sure what that means. So break that down.
Yeah, so radioisotope is like a it's like an element that we can track. So radio, not being radio like active, like damaging, it just labels. It puts a label or a tracking device on a cell, so that then when we can scan it and we can see where that cell is. I don't know if that does an adequate job, but it's not that's damaging to the body. It's not an additive to the cell. It's just like putting like a tag on, like if you're tracking the migratory pattern of birds or something. It's like putting a tracer or a track on the bird, and then you can see where the bird's going.
Great. All right. And so, sorry. And so then you were saying, if you label cells for the purpose of looking at where they go or what they do, the importance of that, or the significance that shows you was what?
Is that cell is out of the body in 3 to 6 months. So it doesn't become this permanent ACL or this permanent cartilage or this you know, this long-term, it doesn't have some sort of building block long-term effect. But what we believe it does, or what the studies that I believe in and what I've learned is that it affects the other cells that are around it. So the long story short of that is you still need to be a healthy organism. It's about the organism's response to these cells. It's not necessarily the cells that are doing the hard labor, so to speak. So long story short is if you take somebody's umbilical cord cells, those umbilical cord cells are just going to have effect on that organism. That organism itself has to rebuild itself. So the same idea with your own young stem cells, they're only going to have their effect around the tissues that they're injected in. So to your question, younger stem cells perform better. I think they do a better job of releasing the chemicals, releasing the signals that tell the body to build itself.
Interesting. Great. And so let me ask you too, I mean, I think it's going to be natural that people say, okay, well, you know, there may be 1,000 clinical trials going on and I'm not really sure whether I'm going to be a candidate for one of those trials, or I'm not really sure when I'm going to need a procedure. Do you, when a patient comes into your office and they ask about banking their cells, I mean, and they say, well, you know, I mean, how young should I be or how old should I be? Or is there some sort of cutoff after which it no longer makes sense for me to consider trying to draw or store them? How do you answer that question?
My answer to that question, I'd say it's too early for me to give you a hard cutoff. In my simple example I give patients is, you know, you still have decent stem cells when if you cut yourself, you heal in a reasonable time. We all have seen those patients that as they start to get older, they start to get more frail, their cuts just last instead of the normal 2-week kind of healing time. It's like, yeah, that was a month and a half ago. That was 2 months ago. The thing still hasn't healed. All right, that organism's starting to shut down. Their stem cells are probably not real potent anymore. Whereas people that are still healing in a reasonable amount of time, yeah, that's healing is the process through stem cells.
Great. And so, you know, some of the numbers we've seen in the data is that, or at least that I've seen in some studies say that, you know, there's kind of this area around maybe 55 or younger. And so there's people who speculate, well, you know, is the health or the potency or the efficacy or the, you know, the strength or endurance sort of the signaling mechanism, is it better when it's below that age? And, you know, I've tried to tell, you know, certain people, I mean, I've seen, you know, triathletes who are in their 60s and they're, you know, they're fanatically healthy and they eat great and they're always working out. And I say, look, you know, you at 60, even if I draw your cells, you know, physiologically, your cells probably, you know, act better than a 45-year-old couch potato who eats fast food and never leaves the couch and watches TV all day and has diabetes and smokes. So, you know, I think your point is great about the fact that when you're trying to assess whether or not somebody's going to heal, it's really more than just, you know, age. Is age really a number, you know, or not? And so do you have anybody at this point who has, you know, banked cells and then and come back and later used them or not yet?
So I haven't had anybody that's used them yet. And the reason that we haven't is because we haven't been doing it long enough where that patient has probably changed significantly from a biologic standpoint. And right now we can't culture expand those cells in the United States. If we were to go back to the bank and use their cells, they would be gone. Meaning we wouldn't have enough to use and still have some in storage. We would end up using them all. So it doesn't make sense from a clinical standpoint yet for any of the patients. One or two things should either have to change. More time would go by and something would change in that patient's physiologic state where they would be better off going back in time and grabbing their younger stem cells to use. Or the culture expansion laws change and we're able to use and culture expand those cells.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So yeah, I've had patients ask me about that, about, you know, if their disease is severe, can they expand their cells? And, you know, we have a discussion about one, you know, compliance with the FDA and the law in the United States, two, about people who have left the United States for treatment who are interested in that. And then three, you know, just notions of whether or not trying to expand cells is going to introduce extra risk when it comes to sterility and infection and how many of those cells are going to be viable and how you rewarm them, et cetera. So there's a lot of technical detail, I think, involved with that. And it'll be really fun and exciting to kind of see the way that the science and the regulatory and compliance issues unwind, you know, as time goes on and as people, you know, either have gotten more data from these clinical trials or who are really, you know, interested in the opportunity to be able to use their own cells to have better outcomes than they otherwise, you know, would with maybe some of the more conventional treatments that we've used for a longer time in medicine that maybe, you know, often which now we're starting to get more data for, and we're looking back and we're, you know, starting to think some of these things maybe that have been done for decades were not as healthy and not as good as maybe advertisers we thought they were. So when somebody comes in and talks to you about, you know, banking their cells, and you're talk with them about trying to get a younger, healthier cell in case they have a physiologic change in the future, does anybody ever come in and say, well, you know, Dr. Nabhadi, I want to know, I mean, when am I going to be able to use this cell? How long is it going to be? I mean, how do you ever have come across that question?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And the answer is we don't know at this point. I mean, you're investing in the future of these studies. And that was my comment earlier, that it is an investment, and similar to like a financial investment, there's risk with that. There is a potential that by banking these cells, there never really is a use for them in the future. It's not known at this point that it will certainly pan out. In my opinion, I think there's overwhelming evidence to say that, yes, this is the future of medicine. And without a doubt, there'll be a use for these cells. Now we need to compare younger. So for example, I'm 42 years old now. I banked my 39-year-old stem cells. So for me, say 15 years from now, I want to use a stem cell to treat some orthopedic condition that I've developed, knee osteoarthritis. Is it better for me to use my 39-year-old, or at that time, are there studies that show that using human umbilical cord is better? I don't know yet. We need to do those studies. We haven't done any of those kind of cost compare, those kind of comparative analysis. I think, and I would hedge my bets on my 39-year-old healthy stem cells thawed, culture expanded, and then re-injected in me is going to be better than using a donor umbilical cord. That's where I would put, you know, if I was a betting man, that's where I would put my money. But we need to do the study and find out. We need to play the game.
Great. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's always really satisfying to find an expert in the field that is giving you their opinion, but then beyond just what the data is or what they've read or what they believe, have enough conviction to actually say, yeah, I went ahead and did this myself because the evidence is so compelling. And I'm sure when your patients come in and they, you know, they ask you or they consult with you about this option, it's much more powerful, you know, for you to be able to say, well, let me tell you what my personal experience is. Can I ask, how did you figure out who you wanted to help you and where to get your cells drawn and how and where to have them stored? How did you navigate that?
Yeah. So at the time, there was only one other orthopedic surgeon in the area doing the stem cell banking for, you know, health reasons, not for any other reason, for cancer treatment or anything. So I went to him. It was a pretty easy decision.
Great. And then talk about, I mean, were you know, as a patient, it's easier for us, I think, as physicians to be objective when it's, you know, someone else that we're treating or someone who's maybe not in your immediate family. But now that, you know, the roles flipped and you became the patient, I mean, was there anything that you were nervous about? Was there anything that you know, had questions about in advance that you feel like a lot of your patients similarly ask before getting an aspiration or a harvesting procedure?
Yeah. It was what's the right word? But it validated what I'm telling my patients, you know, what I was taught when I was taught how to, you know, what the procedure is apparent, what it apparently feels like and what you're going to experience. It validated everything I was telling my patients. So it was actually quite an easy experience. Honestly, I did it first thing in the morning. I was back to work 30 minutes later and had very little and to almost no discomfort. I didn't use any kind of anesthesia, any Valium or anything like that for the procedure. The only time I noticed any symptoms was if I was like sitting up against a hard back chair, or if I was doing sit-ups and, you know, on a hard surface, when my area of the pelvis that we draw from, the posterior superior iliac spine, the very backside of your hip bone, when that would contact some sort of hard surface for about 4 or 5 days, I had discomfort, but that was all. It was actually quite validating and very, very tolerable.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, because, you know, we have, I would say common questions that we get from patients are, you know, is this going to be incredibly painful because you're going to put either, you know, a needle or some kind of drill, even in certain cases, which actually we don't use here. Many people do. you know, into my bone marrow. God, that's going to be, you know, horribly painful. You know, and part of my response to that is, you know, when I was still in residency, I spent a month in the hematology oncology unit, and all we did was go all day long from bed to bed to draw bone marrow. And most of those people never got any kind of sedation at all. And then the next question is often, you know, how deep can you get me? Can I get, you know, do I need to be put totally out? Do I need general anesthesia? Is it like a colonoscopy or I'm in some kind of twilight? And people are often, I think, surprised at how well and effectively this procedure can be done, especially if done under image guidance and especially if done with, you know, a good local anesthetic block. And we're, you know, we've talked a little bit before on the show about anesthetics and how they affect viability of cells. So we have a protocol for that, but people tend to do quite well with it and also have very few, if any, complications. And I think a common question is what you brought up, where people say, well, you know, am I going to have a lot of pain after the procedure, you know, around the needle site? And usually, you know, my response is that really has not been something that patients have complained of. I think if anything, you know, people have, you know, some pain around the injection site, you know, so not the aspiration site, but the injection site for usually the next 72 hours or so, but really don't have significant pain from the place where the bone marrow gets drawn. It's nice to kind of hear a little bit about your story and hear that, you know, really was your experience as well. So another question that I would ask you, Tom, is we do get people, some people are very, you know, very well educated and they've been, you know, reading about these procedures and they ask very sophisticated questions and they have a great understanding of the purpose of biologics and why to use them. And they'll say, well, you know, if I'm going to come in and have my cells drawn, and this sometimes extends beyond just bone marrow. Sometimes we're also talking about, you know, platelets for platelet-rich plasma. And they'll say, well, how can I make sure that the draw that I get is the best yield or is the best possible, you know, quality that I get? And different people kind of have different answers to that. But how do you counsel patients in that regard?
So, yeah, I think those are really important questions that hopefully our work with, you know, you and I use the same processing lab. So our work with a processing lab similar to the ones that we're using, where we're actually doing an analysis of the draw, whether it's a bone marrow draw or a blood draw prior to injecting, will help us tease out what exactly are the most important things to prep our patients properly. That's the first variable I think we have some control over in getting the good outcomes is how potent is our product. And so the things I talk to my patients about, sleep, diet, exercise, and supplements. There's, I think, decent evidence to show that obviously good sleep does wonders for your body. So it's important to make sure you're getting adequate amounts of sleep. The diet, that data is all over the place. My consultation, my patients follow, you know, a clean whole foods type diet. You know, avoiding processed foods, avoiding fast foods, whether intermittent fasting, true intermittent fasting, where you're going days without eating is necessary versus more of a time-restricted feeding. I don't have a hard recommendation for my patients, but I do refer to a local nutritionist and say that that's oftentimes one of the recommendations that comes out of her consultation with them. And as far as supplements go, you know, there's a lot of stem cell activator supplements on the market. I can't fully endorse one over many or the others. I can tell you, I don't think they hurt anything. The things that make sense to me are the basic building blocks, things like glucosamine, relatively higher doses of vitamin C, fish oil. And then as far as exercise goes, I'm a high-intensity interval training advocate. I do think that makes a big difference. Again, there's a couple studies that show that might be something that improves stem cell production and improves our harvest counts. But those are things that as we really start to track and dive deep into this data, those are all the variables I would like us to be monitoring, you know, the types of exercise. But that's what I'm telling my patients at this time.
Great. Yeah. And I think that's a great summary of not just what you do, but I think what a lot of other people out there practicing in the biologic space are considering when they consider really the holistic picture of someone's health and not just, you know, well, here's a supplement, this will be great. You know, it's really a complex interaction probably between, you know, diet as well as environment. And we often talk about exercise as well. And military guys in particular, I've noticed there was a type of therapy that was developed for military members who needed to counteract muscle atrophy, even when they had weight-bearing restrictions on their limb. And that's called blood flow restriction therapy. And it's a class one FDA medical device that's used under supervision. But I mean, it's interesting because if I see military guys here in the clinic, they'll come in and they'll say, you know, hey, I need to get, you know, my PT or my blood flow restriction therapy. I need to do that on the day that I'm going to have my draw before I come in. And, I tell them, I think that's, we help coordinate that for people. Is there a study that kind of shows that that's going to give you the best possible draw? No. But is there at least some theory or some science behind it? I think that, you know, there is some science or some theory to suggest why that's going to be helpful for people. And do you, there's a couple of other people that I've talked to now that have also said, you know, maybe how or whether or not we give people any type of IV fluid is somehow related to, you know, whether or not they're going to have a successful draw. We do talk with people about being hydrated well, but have you noticed anything or have you read anything about that?
I have. No. So there's two that after I finished my sentence that came to mind. One is hormone optimization as well. I think it's something we should evaluate, you know, people's hormone levels. And then two is IV hydration and IV vitamin therapy. I think there are definite reasons why that would make it important. I mean, the whole idea is to optimize the specimen, the organism, prior to drawing the cells that are going to be coming from that organism. It's a pretty simple concept, but the execution of that concept is, it's going to take just, I think, a lot of assumptions. I don't know that we'll ever be able to do really good studies that identify one specific variable that changes between this subset of, you know, 1,000 people and that subset of 1,000 people, because there's so many variables that go into optimizing all of those variables that we just talked about.
Tom, we are going to kind of wrap up here for a little bit, but I just wanted to thank you so much for being on our show today for Too Young to Fail. And thank you for talking about your experiences with stem cell banking and when to do it and things that would otherwise kind of help people have the best chances for success. Anything else that you would like to leave us with from the regenerative medicine clinic in Michigan?
No, you know, I guess the only other item that I was going to bring up and didn't was I haven't just banked myself, but I've banked multiple family members. My brother, I have an 18-year-old, now 19-year-old daughter. We banked her 18-year-old stem cells. So
wow,
it is something that that I truly do believe in. And if it's something you're considering, don't be afraid of the procedure. The procedure is the least, should be the least of your worries.
And certainly if you're in the Michigan area or you're close by, please check out Dr. Tom Nabody and his website if you like. And if you're down here in the Southeast, please check out georgiaboneandjoints.org or check us out on Facebook, YouTube, podcast channel. We are happy to see patients both here and those that fly in to take advantage of the Atlanta airport. So thanks again for joining us on episode 5, Too Young to Fail. Again, I'm your host, Trevor Turner, MD, RMSK, on the Orthobiologics Podcast.